I start talking before the 7:30. Since the group is small, maybe some people may be persuaded to participate, give me some feedback, some comments, some questions. It did work after a while, but so I'll try again here. Right. So any comments or questions from previous weeks? For those of you who have attended the sessions, anything? Everything is crystal clear. So clear that you cannot remember what I said the last few weeks. Or are gone. You're left with imprint.
How did you actually judge yourself? What is a good meditation? And so far, a balance between
So how can I judge my meditation session? In terms of whether it is good or bad, it's too lax or too agitated. Okay. What is a good meditation session in short? Okay. I give you a peculiar answer from me, alright? Every single meditation session you're going to do from now on, every single one, you must label it as good. Okay? It doesn't matter what happened during the meditation. It's always going to be good. Even if you fall asleep, even if you spend the whole time daydreaming, even if you spend the whole time plotting how to commit murder, anything that happens, good or bad, nice, pleasant experiences, unpleasant experiences, you label it as good. Okay? Why I say that is, after you label it as good, then you ask yourself the question, what is good about this meditation? What can I learn from this meditation session that I just had? Not during the meditation. Don't evaluate yourself during the meditation, after the meditation. And you ask yourself, what have I learned from this meditation? About myself or about things in general, about reality. What is so good about this session? It's always good. But the question is, what is good about it? It can be good because you realize that you cannot stay awake. You are actually physically very exhausted, so you're always sleeping. So that gave you an indication that experience in your meditation tell you something about the circumstances of your life and what have you been doing. Maybe you have been overworking, or maybe you're just chronically sleep deprived, right? And if you're sleep deprived, there's nothing you can do to improve your meditation apart from sleeping. You just have to sleep until you overcome sleep deprivation. And then your meditation will progress on it. Yeah. I know a lot of people, they are completely sleep deprived and they feel that they should sit down on a meditation cushion and somehow a miracle will happen. And they will transcend sleep. And they will have alertness and stillness and bliss. Even though they probably couldn't even stay awake. Yeah. So they are working against reality, against the actual conditions of their life. So meditation reveals that to you. If I fall asleep, oh, maybe I'm just tired. If my mind is very agitated, a lot of anxiety, I keep going back to a certain incident, a certain event, then you can tell yourself, oh, actually, I'm very, very much affected by that particular event in my life. Right? And it is, what its impact on me is revealed in my meditation. There's a lot of anxiety, a lot of anxious thoughts. Yeah. So that is the condition that is affecting your meditation. So if you don't want to experience anxiety, you must say, oh, what can I do to change the conditions in my life? Maybe, so in fact, you can make use of the meditation as a way to work with the anxiety, yeah, because that is triggered by something in my life. Okay? Or you find that you are very restless. That's also one experience people have. They try to sit and they just can't sit still. There's this kind of very unease, you know, this restlessness that comes into them, and sort of, and they keep looking at the clock. Say, oh, still not time yet. Yeah. Restlessness is a major hindrance, but it has many different reasons why we are restless. So then that meditation session become one where you can explore, why am I restless? I now I'm experiencing restlessness. What does it tell me about myself? So because you will not be free of it until you uncover the causes and conditions that give rise to it. Okay? So in short, all meditation sessions are good sessions. Right? If you know how to approach it, you know how to learn from every single one of them, including those that you fall asleep the entire time, those that you are completely distracted the entire time, and those that you are plotting to murder somebody. They all have something to teach us about ourselves. Alright? That's my strange answer. Yeah. And then, after you did that, if you can accomplish it, people ask you, oh, you meditate. How's your meditation lately? Say, excellent, wonderful, awesome. Of course, you don't tell them what exactly happened during your meditation. Yeah. And then you will find that that is the major hurdle that you have overcome. The people's mind are like yo-yo. You know, if the meditation session the day is a bit more peaceful and blissful, they're very happy. Good session, good session. Then usually the next session is absolutely lousy. Because they will get too greedy, you know, they will have a lot of craving, they want, I want the peace, I want it back, I want the bliss. And of course that one thing interferes with the meditation, and then they will be very upset, they will say, I have a bad session, my mind just cannot settle. So that's what happened to most people, good and bad, and good and bad, 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 and then disappear, no more meditation. But whereas if you stop labeling them good and bad, and if you look at a different, from a different perspective, you find that actually, regardless of what happens, there's something beneficial that can come out of the meditation. And every little step of it is a progress, you know, it's leading me to have a deeper understanding of myself, allow me to work with the conditions that affect, my body and mind, be it in meditation or outside of meditation. And eventually you will come to a point where it becomes something enjoyable and beneficial regardless of what actually happened in the session itself. Okay, so that's my thing. So let's start today's session. So I've been going through what I call preparing the foundation for us to have realization, for us to gain our own experience of the Buddha's teaching. Buddha presented various different teachings in his discourses and present different ideas and offer different ways of practice. So it's important to be able to experience that in our own life. You know, so Lama Yeshe, one of the founder of this organization to which this center belongs to, so Lama Yeshe used to say that you need to give them a taste of the chocolate. Right? So it's like sampling, right? Like you go to the supermarket or whatever, they give out samples, right? You taste, oh, this is nice. Then you will fork out the money to buy it, right? So you must have the taste of the Dharma. So it's something that you personally experience and you know to be true for yourself. And if you don't have, once you have the taste, then you will be motivated to say, oh, how can I have more of it? How can I have a deeper experience? Or how can I make it a part of my life? You know, something that is becomes a regular part of your life. Okay? So if you don't have the taste, then all you have is just words. Words, I can tell you, are a pale comparison to the taste. Like Singaporeans, we love taste, right? We will travel from one end of the island to the other just to eat that particular food, or we love to queue also. We just queue up in this long queue. Sometimes you may not even know which shop you're queuing for, but you just join the queue. Must be good, right? So many people queue up. And usually it has to do with food, isn't it? To be able to experience the food. And the same with Dharma. The Dharma only truly satisfy us and truly benefit us if we can taste it, we can experience it. Although it's helpful to expand our knowledge to have different ideas, different concepts. But what really matters is the actual experience of it. So the actual taste of it. Okay. So preparing the foundation is how can we start to taste the true flavor of Dharma teaching. And we can actually see it in our own life, in our own experience. And that is the best way to convince ourselves the validity of what we are learning under what we call Buddha's teaching. Yeah. So far I've covered a few conditions that are favorable, that were helpful. One of them is cultivating a quality of calm abiding, yeah, which I'll revisit again. Calm abiding, a state of mind which is calm of all forms of disturbance and are able to allow your attention to abide continuously on whatever it is that you are focusing on. So calm abiding. Previous two sessions I touched on condition of accumulating merit. This is what we call in Buddhism accumulating merit, accumulating positive potentials or positive momentum. And I give a metaphor or analogy that it's like enriching the soil so that the soil in which we're going to plant some seeds or whatever is full of nutrients that is able to nourish and support the growth of the plant. Right? So it's something that we do that accumulating positive, favorable conditions for our own transformation. Yeah. So different activities, but usually classify under three types. Activities of giving, our generosity, our sense of abundance. Yeah. So giving, be it you give in as charity to those that you need, giving in the context of a religious context, like for example making offerings, putting beautiful offerings on the shrine and so on. The second one, activity, is ethics, you know, living our life, following our own ethical principles, living an ethical life. So that act of restraining ourselves from actions that are harmful or non-virtuous, and then encouraging ourselves to participate to create virtuous actions, that also accumulate merits. And the third activity is meditation, cultivating the mind, familiarizing the mind with virtuous quality, good quality. One that is singled out by the Buddha is the quality of loving kindness, or metta in Pali, which actually means friendliness. This kind of warm heartedness, openness towards others, that regard one another in a friendly manner, of kindness. That is loving kindness. Okay, so those three activities, as we cultivate them, we are accumulating so-called merits. We are enriching accumulating that positive energy or momentum that allow us to actualize the Buddha's teaching. Okay. Then last thing I talk about, another practice we do, that of rejoicing. Right? Rejoicing, cultivating the quality of joy, sometimes called sympathetic joy, which helps to increase that merit. So joy is defined as feeling happy for either ourselves or others when we experience happiness or good fortune. So we rejoice, we feel happy. Or we rejoice in the creation of the causes of happiness. Not so much experiencing the results of happiness, but while we are actively or creating the causes of happiness. So when we see someone doing something virtuous, you know, giving for a worthwhile cause, or really trying to live his or her life in an ethical way, or they're meditating, or in any other virtuous activity, then we feel happy for them. We rejoice in what they're doing. So that's what it means by cultivating joy. But all you are aware of someone who experienced some good fortune or some auspicious conditions in their life, something good, or they're happy. Then you feel happy for them. And that is also a form of rejoicing. Okay. Last week I mentioned it's not as easy as you think it is, okay? Because there's a lot of hindrance to joy, jealousy, envy, belittling, demeaning. Don't make such a big fuss. No big deal. Just give a little bit of money. Why talk so much about it? Okay. So that is when we belittle or we sort of demean that activity. When we feel bored, boredom is also the opposite of joy. We're not interested. Oh, don't tell me all your things you have done. I'm not interested. Go away. Yeah. Boredom. So, there are quite a few of these instinctive reactions that are the opposite of joy. Okay. So, and today I'm going to talk about another favorable condition, which is usually called purification, or I prefer to call it acknowledgement of past mistakes or misdeeds. Right. But before I get to that, let's revisit calm abiding. So, calm abiding, which we usually cultivate in meditation. So far I talk about a few things about this time meditation. I usually introduce it in a three-step process. So some of you would have. Anyway, by the time of the end of the course, you probably burn into your consciousness. Yeah. First step, I call it acquiring a seat. It means really taking care to find both a physical seat and also a physical posture that are supportive of your meditation practice. One that allows your body to be stable and balanced and safe. And also allow, most important actually, with your spine to be upright in a natural way, but without introducing unnecessary tension, tightness, or even pain. So we don't really want, pain. Right? Pain is the body signal that something is wrong. Why are you sitting in a posture that is wrong? To start off with, what's the point of it? I mean, you do it more wrong, then you will suddenly one day become right. You know? So, of course, traditionally people sit cross-legged on the floor. And that is if you are used to that posture. If you are not used to the posture, I can tell you, it can create a lot more problems than you bargain for. You probably end up damaging your lower back. That's a very fragile part of the human body in the modern world, the lower back. You can aggravate existing conditions. You know, you may hurt your knees, and so on and so forth. And basically, it just makes the whole meditation experience highly unpleasant. You know, if the posture is not suitable for your body. No need to look at what other people are doing. If they're not, their body are not your body. Right? So, a lot of time I joke that meditation is a bit like modern yoga. It's there to appear, to allow people to look at you. So we quite often become very concerned with how we look as opposed to how we feel, how we sense from within. And every time if I do yoga in a group and I'm concerned with how I look, I almost always injure myself. When you tend to push yourself too much, you don't listen to the cues of the body, you know, say, don't do it, you know, my thing. Otherwise, it's so embarrassing, everybody is doing that and I'm not. You know, how can I bear that? Yeah. So that's why I don't do yoga in a group. I just do it on my own. So that's the first step, posture. Second step, to take some time to allow body and mind to transition into meditation and to find ways to help them to do that. So far, I talk about returning your attention to your own body. Simply just bring your attention back and notice how your body is feeling in this very moment. No, and you can do it part by part. No. Last week I introduced the breath and asked you to, by returning your attention to the breath, not just the breath in one particular spot, but just the breath sensation throughout the body, it also automatically make you become aware of how your body is feeling. No. How is my neck feeling? How's the face? How's the shoulders? How's the pelvis, the hip, the lower back? No. So the breath can also help us to reconnect our attention to our whole body. Today I want to talk about, having done that, you might already experience that once we turn our attention to the body, we rebuild the connection between mind and body. A natural process will happen in which the body starts to release the different type of reaction, bodily, physical reaction, quite often in the modern world, to stress. So it manifests in different form of holding or tensing, tightening. Sometimes also a lifelong habit of maybe not so good posture. I have very bad posture. If I sit on a chair like that, I tend to slide down, until only my neck and my back is in touch with the chair. So I'm basically balancing my body on these two points. But I thought, yeah, terrible posture. So all those bodily reactions that we have accumulated within our body, those reactions interfere with the settling process of body and mind in meditation. So it's helpful to address that bodily reaction first. Doesn't mean that you relax perfectly and completely, but at least you address it. And as you address it, as the body are able to release some of the unnecessary tightening and tension, well, how does the body feel more comfortable, more at ease? And you actually really settle down into the posture, and the posture becomes more and more comfortable, more and more supportive. In fact, sometimes when the process went really well, and your body is so comfortable, it doesn't fidget, it doesn't move, it's inclined towards complete stillness. And once that happens, then quite often people report the experience of my body disappear in meditation. I don't feel my body at all. What happened to my body? It's kind of gone. That is actually a good sign. The reason why you keep feeling your body is you feel uncomfortable, you move, you fidget, and every time you move, there is a change in your bodily sensation. And so your brain picks up that the human perception rely mostly on change, the perceived change. So every time you move, you become aware of that part of the body is not comfortable, and move again. So throughout the whole meditation, you become preoccupied with adjusting your posture. You become very agitated by the body that is not comfortable, not at ease, So, whereas when you're really comfortable, then of course you don't have to move, right? You're comfortable. Why do you need to move? And as you incline to stillness, so the sensation that goes to your brain from one moment to another is more or less the same. You didn't move, right? So as far as the brain is concerned, the same, I just ignore. Right? So eventually, it ignores sensations from your entire body. And so you have this experience, this strange experience, where you don't seem to have a body in meditation. And after you get over the weirdness of it, it actually feels quite well, quite nice. Because now the body is not bothering you. No more aches and pains that kind of keep pulling your attention towards them and away from what you are meditating. Okay? So what I want to emphasize today is this step. After you become aware of your own body, how can you help it to release some of the unhelpful bodily reaction or tension? How can I facilitate it? It wouldn't be perfect, but at least some of it will go. And then the more it goes, the more that sort of disappears or dissipates, the more comfortable I am, the more settled I am physically. All right. A lot of time when people start meditating, we are all very impatient. We heard a description. In meditation, you will feel concentrated. You will have no thoughts, no distraction. You'll be able to focus all the time on your breath. And meditation teachers are guilty of this. Because we tell people this. We told them this is what to expect. Of course, we also didn't tell them that. Even we ourselves can't do it. Yeah. So we have this, people have this image in their mind, and so we strive right from the beginning to get there, to get a calm, still, focused mind. Right. The calm, still, focused mind will eventually arrive. I don't have any doubts about it. But before that, there's a lot of things need to happen before you get there. Right. So right from the first session, if you strive for it, you're going to be disappointed. Because unless the conditions are there, are in place, that won't come into your experience. Your mind won't be calm, your mind won't be still, won't be focused. But there are a lot of other things happening that are disturbing your mind. First and foremost, your body. The body is not comfortable. The body experiences tension, aches, even pain. Then your mind will not be calm and still and focused, isn't it? Your mind will be wondering, how can I get rid of this pain? Or maybe I shouldn't sit on this cushion. I should sit on the other cushion. In a long retreat, this is what preoccupies you. Oh, the draft from the aircon is too cold. I shouldn't sit in this spot. The sunlight is too bright or whatever. You know, all sorts of things that hinder or kind of affect your physical comfort comes to mind and affect your meditation. So I recommend people not to worry too much about what happened in your mind. Don't worry if your mind is distracted. Don't worry if it's sleepy. Don't worry if you are daydreaming all the time. Do not worry too much about the condition of your mind. But you take note of it, you notice it. But instead, put your energy initially on creating helpful conditions for your mind and body to settle. So make it the priority at the beginning to say, oh, let me first help my body to settle down. Right? And then there are a few other things in between before we get to the point of doing something directly to our mind. In fact, if you do that, you might be surprised sometimes just by settling your body. You haven't done anything about your mind. You haven't tried to make it calmer or make it brighter or do anything. But just by settling your body, suddenly your mind becomes so much calmer, less thought, less agitated. You know? So the result you want will come along automatically as a byproduct of taking care of the initial steps of settling your body. And that's what I'm trying to present. Okay? Now, releasing bodily reactions, you don't have to only do it in this meditation posture. I think yesterday a friend told me that he found that after he had his swimming and then he did his meditation goes much better, much deeper. And my reason, my explanation for it is as you swim, you engage in not all physical activity, but some physical exercise help you to release some of the tension, the stress, the unnecessary tension. And so you feel much more at ease physically. And under that condition, when you sit down and meditate, you have already created a condition of releasing your bodily reaction. I don't mean that you have to jump out of the swimming pool immediately and get into a meditation posture and meditate, okay? Don't have to do that. But so long as the effect of the activity or like the exercise remain and is something favorable, and you find that if you meditate within that duration, then you might gain the benefit of it. Other kind of activity would be yoga, hatha yoga, which is traditionally, I think in the yoga tradition, it is the asana, the pose, developed to help in meditation. Yeah, because if you study yoga, there's eight limbs in the Yoga Sutra. And after the asana, there will be pranayama, I think, which is breath regulation. And then following that will be the other practices to do with meditation. So some form of yoga, as you engage in it, at the end of it, it helps to stretch the body, it helps the body to relieve it of some of the tension and the tightening and contraction, and make it more favorable as you sit down to meditate, you know, that to help you to release the bodily reaction. Okay. And I think Qigong may also help, some form of Qigong. You read things that are not too strenuous, because if you feel physically tired, then it will be a bit harder to meditate with alertness, because you're already too tired. Okay. So you can also work with bodily reaction by engaging in some form of exercise. And that really depends on the individual. You just test out and see what works best for you. Okay? So I've been going on and on. Any questions up to this point? So, let's give it a try. Okay? So let's do a meditation on calm abiding. And this time, my emphasis is how can we help our body to release at least some of the bodily reaction, some of the tension and tightness. So I introduced this before, and today we're going to revisit this. It's a modified form of what's called yoga nidra. Nidra means sleep, so yogic sleep. And in this, my version of it, I'm asking you to return your attention to different parts of the body, crown, forehead, throat, right shoulder, right elbow, this very long-winded, part by part kind of thing. And today's instruction is, on the in-breath, as you feel yourself breathing in, the code word is touch. So to be in touch with that part of the body. So if you are placing your attention on the crown, as you breathe in, try to also notice sensations of the crown. And as you breathe out, the code word is release. You just tell yourself this word, release. Right? You don't actually have to do anything. You don't have to physically make it relax. You don't have to say, go away, go away. No, you just remind yourself with this word, release. Because as you breathe out, we release the carbon dioxide, the stale air in our lungs, then maybe some of those tightness, tension in any part of my body might also go with my breath. And maybe some of the things that occupy my mind, maybe they can also go with the breath. So breathe in, be in touch, breathe out, release. So this release is very relaxing. You don't have to do anything. You just have to remind your own body and mind, oh, this is an opportunity for you to release. If you release, it's good. You don't, that's also fine. Right. So touch and release, and we're going to go through our body in that way. And see whether along the way, maybe some of the bodily reaction might also be released with it. Okay. So I'll guide you through it. But first, let me test this gong, this singing bowl. Alright. We'll use a modern device. Okay, so get yourself in position. Much nicer. Alright. So first step, settle your body into a supportive meditation posture, and I'll guide you through this meditation. But feel free to ignore me. If what I'm saying doesn't correspond to your experience or not helpful, feel free to do the meditation in whichever way is that suits you the best. Most important in the posture is to make sure that your back, your spine feels comfortable in an upright position without straining your back muscles. No need to tense up your back to straighten it. Leave it in an upright position. And just make sure that your chest feels open so that you can breathe freely and easily. In my meditation, it's perfectly fine to close your eyes completely. Rest your hands, your arms in such a way that allow your shoulders to be relaxed. Feel that your whole body is resting or sitting on the seat, on the floor. Feel that solidity, firmness, and stability beneath you. So sensations we associate with the ground, with the earth. We feel that they're here to support your body, to keep it balanced and safe. So naturally, your body will automatically start the process of loosening up, releasing unnecessary tightness and tension so that it can settle down comfortably into this posture that you have adopted. So that is step one, acquiring a seat for yourself in meditation. And for step two, making transition, helping body and mind to make that transition into meditation. We're going to do this modified yoga nidra. I'm going to invite you to place your attention at different parts of your body, one at a time, starting at from the crown of your head. See if you can rest your attention at the crown, the topmost part of your body. And if you can, synchronize with your natural breath so that as you breathe in, you are in touch with the crown. You are aware of the sensations here. Sensations of tingling, warmth or coolness, a slight sense of pressure, or maybe nothing at all, which is also perfectly fine. And as you breathe out, just remind yourself in your mind with the word release. Breathing out, body and mind can release anything unwanted, unhelpful. So breathe in, be in touch, breathe out and release at your own pace, at the crown of your head. And then see if you can allow your attention to flow downwards towards your forehead so that as you breathe in, you are in touch with sensations at your forehead. And as you breathe out, you remind yourself to release. Notice whether you are tensing up the muscles of your forehead, and you can even expand the scope. And notice whether are you tensing up any muscles in your face. So breathe in, be in touch with your forehead, with your face. Breathe out and release. See if you can, as you breathe out and release, you may be able to relax the muscles of your forehead, the muscles of your jaw, or even the muscles around your eyes. So much so that your whole face may feel a bit softer, more relaxed, more comfortable. Let your attention flow downwards now to your throat, so that as you breathe in, allow yourself to be in touch with sensations here, and as you breathe out, release at your throat. So that you notice sensation in the throat. At any point of the time in your meditation, if you want to clear your throat, please go ahead. No need to suppress it. Maybe you also notice sensation of the muscles in your neck. You tensing them up, tightening them up. And as you breathe out, once again, remind yourself to release. So feel free to vary the pace. You don't have to follow exactly what I'm saying. And I invite you now to return your attention to your body, to your right shoulder. Just pick a spot, rest your attention somewhere on your right shoulder. And as you breathe in, be in touch, be aware of sensations here. And as you breathe out, release. If you can, become aware of any tightness or tension or discomfort or the opposite, sensation of relaxation and comfort of your right shoulder. So moving on, not to worry if the shoulder still feels tight or tense. That's perfectly fine. Let your attention travel down to your right elbow. Rest your attention here. As you breathe in, be in touch, be aware. As you breathe out, remind yourself to release at your right elbow. Let that attention flow further down to your right wrist. Let the attention be in touch as you breathe in, release as you breathe out, and your right wrist. Extend your attention into your right hand. Become aware of sensations in your right hand as you breathe in and as you breathe out. Release. Be aware of sensations in your palm, the back of the hand, down the fingers, all the way to the fingertips. And as you breathe out, as you release, see if you can release the weight of your right arm. Allow it to rest comfortably on this support. No need to tense up your arm muscles unnecessarily. So let's switch sides. Place your attention now on the left shoulder. Just as before, breathing, be in touch, out and release. And let that attention flow down to your left elbow so that as you breathe in, you are in touch, you are aware. As you breathe out, you can release. Not to worry if your attention wander off elsewhere. Every time I say something, it's an invitation to come back to your own body. Let attention flow further down to left wrist. Breathe in, be in touch, out then release. Extend your attention into your left hand so that you are aware of sensations in your hand, in the palm, down the fingers. Let you breathe out, releasing. See if you can release the weight of your left arm. Allow it to rest completely on the support. then let your attention come back to the center of the body at the level of your chest and your heart center. Breathing in, being touched, the sensations here. Maybe you can feel the movements of your chest, the beating of your heart. And let's breathe out, release. Let your attention flow further down to your navel region, breathing, be aware of sensation at your abdomen, at your belly. Breathe out, release. Let your awareness sink even further down to the base of your spine, the tip of your tailbone. Just rest your attention at that spot. Breathe in, be in touch, be aware. Breathe out and release. As you breathe out, imagine releasing the weight of your pelvis comfortably onto your seat and surrender it to gravity. And now let's move down both legs at the same time. So place your attention on both hip joints. So don't have to be precise, just roughly be aware of sensations at both hips. Rest your attention here as you breathe in and be in touch. Breathe out and release. Place your attention on both knees. Become aware of sensations at both knees as you breathe in and as you breathe out, release. Extend your attention down to both ankles. Just locate both your ankles as you breathe in. Be aware, be in touch. As you breathe out, remind yourself to release. Let your attention flow into both feet so that you notice sensation in both feet, the soles of your feet, the toes. As you breathe out, release the weight of both legs, allow them to rest comfortably on the floor, on the ground. So we have gone through the whole body from crown all the way to the feet. In this one last place, let's come back to the face. So often we do tense up muscles of the face again, as we try to listen to the instructions, try to decipher them. Like you breathe in, be in touch with your face, be in touch with the forehead, and as you breathe out, release any tension in your face. The meditation is almost over now. You can relax, let go of all those tightening and tension in the face. Let your whole face feel soft, at ease, and comfortable once again. So rest your attention on your breath. Let the breath be your anchor, the support. And you can come back to it for the rest of the meditation. I invite you to enjoy any pleasant sensations that you notice in your body. Having gone through the whole body, reconnecting with it, being in touch and releasing. See if you can allow yourself to enjoy any sense of relaxation, any sense of relief in your body. And you can continue to release as you breathe out. Okay, so that is a meditation emphasizing releasing our bodily reactions. So this method that I share with you works for me, but may not work for you. It doesn't matter. No, you just have to find a way that allows your body to really settle down, really start to release some of the tension and tightness, so that as you continue to meditate, you feel more and more comfortable, more and more at ease in your physical posture. So that's the important thing. Okay, so is that clear? Yeah.
As you mentioned, the stage where you need the tension also when people are performing the work.
Yeah.
So, what I find is that, especially when I travel, Japan, I get to the stage, I can get to the stage. So that,
you cannot, you can get to a stage where the body, yeah.
Especially when you travel, the first time.
So, uh-huh.
But, when you get to the sleep, I get to sleep, so your mind is always
alert.
Yes.
So your body, you're saying is, especially when you're traveling, you experience jet lag, you're able to get the body to be relaxed. But the mind doesn't relax. Don't get to sleep.
Okay, so you're using meditation to sleep. Okay, right. Yeah. Sleep is a, not able to sleep is a major issue. There are various things involved here. From the meditation point of view, after we settle our body, what we do is, so we call it mindfulness of the body. After the way I present it, after mindfulness, or not me, but Buddha presented it, I just copy him. I repeat him. So next is mindfulness of feeling. Feeling means sensation, pleasant sensation. See, because what happens is when the body feels more and more relaxed, there's a higher chance that pleasant sensation starts to arise. Sensation of feeling very comfortable, very relaxed, you know, very kind of soft and at ease. Those feelings start to make an appearance. And the thing about the mind is, the reason why after body is feeling is, when the mind contacts pleasant feelings, it feels very reassuring. It reassures the mind. The mind feels safe, feel like, oh, okay, everything is fine. You know why? Because if you're in danger, really your life is in threat, you won't feel, oh, it's so relaxed, so at ease. So comfortable? No, not at all. In fact, you'll probably be overwhelmed with unpleasant feelings of anxiety, of fear, you know. And those feelings correspond to the situation. It's dangerous. So I need to tense up my muscles for fight or flight. Okay? So sleep is the opposite, right? You don't want to be in a fight or flight mode, isn't it? So that's why if after you can settle the body, you try to pay attention to the feeling, the pleasant feeling. Yeah. So the pleasant feeling, the more you notice them, the more you enjoy them, the more you appreciate them, they have a function of settling the mind. They have a function of calming the mental reaction, the mental reactivity. One of which is sleep is, oh, tomorrow is so important. I really must get to sleep now. I must sleep now so that I have enough time to sleep so that I can wake up the next morning, huh? It of course doesn't work that way, but we have those thoughts, you see, we have those thoughts intrude into our experience. And the longer you lie there, the more anxious you get because, oh no, I have less time to sleep. I must really get to sleep now. I don't know whether it's your experience or not, but, so that's why I say one way you can counteract that and help yourself to fall asleep is after you settle the body, you place your attention on pleasant feelings. If your body is settled, there are bound to be some pleasant feelings in the body. And you just let yourself enjoy those pleasant feelings. Yeah. Of course, you can count the sheep if you want. But see, the thing is, you're trying to reduce your mental reactivity or activity, basically. Right? So if you can settle the body, the next thing in meditation, and likewise for sleep, is to rest your attention on pleasant sensations. So if you can contact those pleasant sensations, then it helps to reassure the mind, it helps to dispel anxiety. Then even if you don't fall asleep, you feel quite alright. Okay, no, it's quite enjoyable. So, yes, then you just let it continue. Sooner or later you will fall asleep, yeah. Yeah. But if you still keep bothering, I'm still not asleep, that thought in itself is disturbing to the mind. My suggestion for lucid dreaming is to read a book on lucid dreaming before you go to sleep. To saturate your mind with the intention, with the kind of awareness of lucid dreaming. If you don't know what lucid dreaming is, it's waking up in your dream while you're dreaming and realize, oh, this is a dream. Yeah. It's the easiest way to saturate your mind before you fall asleep with the intention or with the awareness of lucid dreaming and the intention to be lucid. But if you cannot sleep, please don't do it. It will just keep you awake. Already you have problem falling asleep. Then you won't. Okay. Yeah, I find that is the easiest way to awaken in the dream, is to retain the awareness and the intention. Okay? Right. So let's talk about the preparatory practice of purification. Or I would like to call it acknowledgement of past mistakes or misdeeds. Because I see this is a hindrance. You can see as a hindrance for us to experience the Buddha's teaching, because we are in a way trapped by our past. Right? We're trapped by our past in terms of one way is feeling guilty of what we have done in the past. The guilt is a very heavy, quite a disturbing emotion. Right? It sort of trapped our attention, our thoughts, our feelings with what we have done in the past. The past is over. We cannot go back and undo the past. Right? So what we need to do is to return attention to the present, and we need to move forward and work for the future. But if the guilt is too strong, then we are sort of constantly revisiting the past. So this is one way that the past is entrapped us. Another way is the past by our activities, what we engage in, we form habits, old habits. But if the old habits are of unskillful action or non-virtuous action, each time we do it, we get stronger and stronger. And so we are stuck in this old habit. And therefore, new change doesn't come in, because you're just kind of recycling, you're going over and over again the old habits. Right? So either way, we need to somehow release ourselves from the past. From our past mistakes, from our past misdeeds, be it the guilt or be it the habits. So the practice of acknowledging past misdeeds is to help us to do that, to clear away these obstacles so that we can allow new experience to come in, new understanding, a shift in perspective to happen. Okay. And so usually, purification practice in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition involves four steps. The sequence doesn't matter, because different times we do it in different ways. I prefer to present it in this way. First is called regret. Regret means you acknowledge that what I have done previously, be it a specific instance or just in general, you know, over many times, that particular action or that particular activity is unskillful or is harmful for myself or others. So regret is to feel, oh, I shouldn't have done it. Or I acknowledge some of the hurt or harm that that might have caused myself or others. Okay. If you don't have regret, you don't need to do anything else. But you feel it's fine, right? So you find why there's need to change. So there's no need to continue your purification. Because basically deep down, you don't really want to change. Right? So change will not happen. So first is to have regret. Right? And regret, I made a distinction between the word regret and guilt, although this distinction is just in terms of words, in terms of how I think about them, okay? Words can be used, these two words can be used interchangeably if you like. But in my own experience, I find that I use the word guilt when I feel very weighed down by the past. Right? I feel like so terrible, I'm a terrible person. Why is it I cannot change? Why am I still doing this? I describe that as guilt. I don't think I'm the only one that experiences guilt, right? Okay. And I find that when I'm in this guilt mode, it's very self-preoccupied. It's all about me. Oh, I'm so bad. I'm so useless. I'm so helpless. Oh, why am I still doing this? Me. And it feels terrible. So unpleasant. You would think that it will help you to change, right? Because it's so unpleasant. But I find that it doesn't. In fact, the more guilt I feel, the less likely it is that I change. I don't know why, but I can beat myself up and do what Christian called penance. No, you. Well, I didn't literally do it. You can use a whip and whip yourself. Oh, I have sinned. My teacher liked the word sin. Namaste Rinpoche. He liked the word sin for negative action. I don't like the word sin. Yeah. So when you, in this sense of guilt, you would think that it promotes change, but I don't think so. I think it's so, you're so preoccupied with your own guilt, with your own mistakes. You feel so bad about it that you just go round and round and round. It's like a very juicy Korean drama, you know, that you don't really want it to stop. You know you're crying, tissue paper, then the next episode, you're gonna cry again. You go up and down, right? So much suffering, and yet you feel glued to it. Oh, what's the next episode? Right? It's so much drama, right? And it's a bit like this. Guilt is a bit like a drama in which you are the protagonist. You are the main person. You know, and life revolves around yourself. And you don't want it to stop. Right? So that's why I find in my case, guilt actually hinders change. So no need to invest so much in guilt. In fact, my friend said, she actually used the word guilt as a verb. Don't let others guilt you. You know, some people are very good at making you feel guilty, isn't it? They really milk it. It's called emotional blackmailing. They make you feel really guilty. Then you will do what they want you to do. Yeah. So don't let others guilt you, and you also don't guilt yourself. Just a more reasonable sense of regret. Recognizing that, I made a mistake. That was really bad. That was not what I really want to do, or that is not in line with what I want to do. Regret is the first step. Okay? Second step is, in Buddhism we call it refuge and altruistic motivation. Okay? So basically it is to take refuge, go for refuge. In the Buddhist context, we go for refuge to Buddha, to his teaching, to the community of practitioners, and to generate a very positive motivation, altruistic motivation. And the way they describe it is, this is the support that help you to stand up again. So I fall down, I slip or fall down on the floor. So the floor, in a way, is the cause of me falling down. And yet I need to rely on the floor, I push against the floor to stand up again. Right? So I might commit some mistakes in relation to others, or I commit some mistakes against the Buddha's teaching. But also I again rely on them, rely on the Buddha, his teaching, his community. This term go for refuge, I don't know whether it makes sense to you. If you rely on them, you place your trust in them. And by relying on them, it helps you to stand up again. And then when I did something wrong or harmful to other sentient beings, other people, I again rely on them. I generate a positive motivation, one that involves love and compassion towards others, that I want to be of benefit to them, to be able to help others as well. So by relying on them, I stand up again. So I go for refuge and I generate a positive motivation. And what I see in this step is to have hope, to not sort of write yourself off and say that, oh, I'm a hopeless case. No, I cannot change. There's no way I can change. This is to say that, well, I can rely on the Buddha, his teaching, my community of fellow practitioners. I can rely on them. I can still generate, again, a positive motivation, even though I have previously followed maybe a harmful intention. When I shout at somebody, I say something hurtful, I behave badly, but I can again regenerate a positive motivation. Right? So this is the second step. The third step is the remedy, which is to do something virtuous and positive, to engage in basically any virtuous activity. Right? Anything virtuous is like a counteracting force. Okay? To do any virtuous activity, although in a Tibetan Buddhist context, there are certain sort of popular things that people do, popular practices people will do for purification. But the teaching actually says any virtuous activity will do. Okay? And the last one is called resolve or resolution. Like your New Year resolution, which most of the time you forget it after the New Year, the next day. But I used to have a lot of problem with this resolution. Because I have a feeling that I will break it. I shall not be angry again. That's completely hopeless. Break it the next moment.
But now I look at it, I think it doesn't matter. You just be as sincere as you can as in what you want to resolve. What you resolve to do or not do. Just give it your best. Right? And not to worry if you fall short of it. The whole idea is to keep at it. To keep at it and keep at it and keep at it. Right? So let's review a bit. Regret, refuge, actually the second one you can call it reliance. Rely on the refuge object, rely on the positive motivation, reliance. Third one is the remedy, which is any virtuous activity. And the fourth one is the resolve, or resolution, to resolve to change, but to make a personal promise to change. Okay. So this is the four steps that allow us to set ourselves free from our past. Okay. Sounds alright? So as I said, the first step, regret, is the most important. You look back and say, I haven't done anything wrong. There's nothing to regret, nothing to purify, and nothing to acknowledge. I don't believe it's true, but anyway, if that's the case, then that's it, alright? So if you don't have a sense of regret, there's nothing to change, isn't it? So the regret is the most important. So until you see that there's something not right about my actions of the past, until I can see that it might be harmful to myself, harmful to others, it might be contradictory to what I want to do or where I want to go, and until you have a sense of regret, purification is not genuine or sincere. So that's the most important step. Easy peasy. Any question about this? Then you regret it. Start again. resolution is a funny one. When you listen to different people, they will resolve in different ways, in line with their personality. One of my teachers would say, I will do my best. not do this or to do that. Yeah, do my best. Then another teacher would say, that is a strange, that one is a bit, like, let's say I'm going to fall asleep soon. I do my purification. Then I go to sleep. So for the next 8 hours, I know I'll be asleep. Then you resolve, for the next 8 hours, I will not get angry. Because you're asleep. I think this second one, take this a bit more seriously. You only resolve what you think you can do, and not resolve in such a way that you might break it again. Yeah. So this is what the second method is. Yeah. I mean, for me, I think you just do what works for you, lah. What makes sense for you. Yeah. Okay. So, purification in the Buddhist context, I like to think of it as not wiping the slate clean. Not about undoing the past. The past is over. You cannot undo it. But what you can do is to change the condition now so that the future will be different. Because if you don't change anything, the past will reassert its effect and the future will be a little bit more, will be similar to the past. So it's like you get caught in a cycle. So what you're trying to do is to break the cycle. But you are not able to undo the past. But sometimes people have an interesting idea about purification. Okay, never mind. I will do this non-virtuous action first. And then I purify. And then everything will be alright. Okay. If you hang around Buddhist circle, try to spend Buddhist circle long enough, you might come across this kind of attitude. And unfortunately, it's not been smart. Okay. Lama Tsongkhapa, which is the founder of the Gelug tradition of which we follow, of Tibetan Buddhism, in his teaching he says, thinking in that way is like you make a vow, you take a vow or precept, you promise to don't do this or don't do that, and then you break it, right? And then you think that if you purify it will be the same. He says, the analogy is like if you were to break your arm, and then you put it back together, you heal it, and then you heal, and then you can use your arm again. Okay? And then you to claim that an unbroken arm
is exactly the same, the broken arm, broken and healed arm, is exactly the same as an unbroken arm. You cannot tell the difference. And that is false. Once you broke your arm once, even if you heal, x-ray, you can see it's broken before. Right? So it's the same. If you create a non-virtuous action, and even if you purify it, it does not undo the fact that you have create a non-virtue. Okay? So there's no such thing as wiping the slate clean. We don't born into this life with a clean slate according to Buddhism. We come with certain baggage, and also certain qualities. So likewise, throughout our life, we add to it. We're changing that composition. But we never have a chance to just say, I just start over again. Let's just wipe everything clean so that I can start over again. No such thing. Okay. So our history follows us. But what we can do with purification is we can actively create, change the condition. We can change the condition so that we are no longer enslaved by our old habits, by our past mistakes, and we can move forward. Okay? So some of the common activities people do as part of their purification practice. I may as well mention it because you might come across this, or if you watch YouTube videos of Tibetan practitioners, they do certain activities. One of them is prostration. And in Tibetan tradition, the full length prostration. Yeah. So if you Google prostration and Bogaya, I don't know, those of you have been to Bogaya, the holy place of Buddhism, around the stupa area within the temple compound. There are a lot of, especially Tibetans, or people who practice in Tibetan tradition, who does this full-length prostration. Usually they use a ball so that you can slide faster, and then you come back up. Okay? And often they do the practice of accumulating 100,000 prostrations. So that is, it takes quite a while and takes some physical strength. Okay? And of course you have to do it with the right attitude, not just like doing burpees like that. No? It's not a physical exercise, but it's an expression of respect, expression of reverence, yeah, towards the Buddha and his teaching and the Sangha. So that is a physical activity, not a meditation, a physical activity that they do. And quite often they do it in conjunction with purification. They do it with awareness of their own past mistakes and with the intention to change. Yeah. So then they engage in that. As I said, any virtuous activity is fine, but there is a popular one. Another one you might have heard of is a recitation of certain mantras, a long string of syllables usually in Sanskrit. Some of them have meaning, but usually you don't worry too much about meaning, just recite them. And there's this one particular practice called Vajrasattva practice. I don't think there's a picture of Vajrasattva. Anyway, it's a white Buddha figure, and is associated with purification. And so you often people do this practice, reciting his mantra. His long mantra has 100 syllables, pretty long. Takes a while to remember it. Huh? Yeah. And then you do certain visualization along with it. There's also another very popular purification practice that they do. Other practice that people do is, they read sutras. I mean, in the old days they recite, but we modern people, we have a problem with memorization. So we cannot recite from memory, so we read. So we read certain sutras or discourses on the Buddha. That is also considered a virtuous activity. And sometimes people do that as part of their purification practice. Or other things is they copy the sutra. Downstairs on level one, I think there's this shelf with all this golden booklet, right? And then some of them are printed with the ink is very faint, right? So that people would just trace out the words. So that is so-called copying a Buddha's discourse, word for word, just copying it up. And that is also supposed to be a meditative virtuous practice. Yeah. Other things is to draw or paint Buddha images. And then if you are not of you don't have the artistic talent, you don't shock people with your painting of the Buddha, you can commission it to be done. You pay money for artists to create one. So in a way, you are either by your own hand or via someone else. You create images, you create holy images, sacred images like painting chankas or actual statues. And they also have a practice of sometimes they make stupa. Do you know what stupa is? The reliquaries, in which usually they put the ashes of a Buddhist master, the ginormous one and the tiny little one. So you can and there is a practice where you use a mold and plaster or whatever, and you actually create the stupa. You create miniature size images of Buddha. So, and this is in the religious context, these are considered virtuous activities. And it's quite amazing when you do it. Okay, you pour the plaster mixture into silicone mold, agitate them. No, and after a while, when it sets, you flip it out. This wonderful sense that you bring something sacred and holy into existence. Make sure your technique is good, right? Otherwise, there's a big air bubble at the face of the Buddha. And you come out where this disappears. No face. That, oh, shit. What am I supposed to do with this image? Well, that would be a tricky business. Sometimes, if possible, you have to repair it. My teacher said, it's not good enough to make a whole bunch of Buddha images full of all these flaws, you know, like bubbles over there, cracks, you know, badly defined, you know, that is not a good practice. Not actually, basically means not enough mindfulness given to the practice. But if you put a lot of mindfulness into it, you really do it, it's a very wonderful activity. That's why it's considered a virtuous activity, to bring beautiful images of a sacred meaning or connotation into existence. So that is another virtuous practice that quite often people do that's associated with purification. Okay, but in general, any virtuous activity doesn't even have to be religious in nature. Even volunteering, helping, giving to charity, in any way you are able to practice with a wholesome, virtuous intention, and plus an intention to purify, to change, is a purification practice. Okay. And so therefore, sometimes it's good not to define virtuous activity in a too narrow a sense, bound up with things that you can only do in a Buddhist center like this, things that you have to do, have something to do with statues and paintings or, no. Because when people define in such a narrow way, then they feel like the whole day when they're at work or with family or they're elsewhere, they are not doing anything virtuous. And that, I think, is a great pity, because when we are at work, when we interact with others, when we are with family, in fact, at any point of time, even when you're sitting on the toilet, there are opportunities to engage in virtuous activity. Right? So you can bring that into your workplace, into your interaction with others, into the different choices you make from day to day and moment to moment. And there are often many opportunities to engage in virtue. Right? For it to be a purification practice, you do need to have an intention beforehand that of those four things, regret, reliance, remedy, and resolve. When you have those four together, then it transforms that activity into a purification practice. Okay? And for example, you decided to have this, to have a long talk with somebody, a long delayed talk with somebody. You might want to enter into it with a positive motivation, the one of saying not to repeat the old mistakes, the old arguments, the old kind of script. Some people have this script, they individually follow the script. Yeah. You say this, then I say that. And then you say this, then I say that. And you say this, then I'm ready to throw something at you. You say you're going to throw something back at me. And this script, yeah, is all mapped out after many, many years of practice. Okay. And so sometimes I suggest virtuous activity can be as simple as when it is time for you to say your line, you keep your mouth shut for a few seconds, long enough for both of you to feel uncomfortable. What happened? Why are you not saying your line? If you don't say your line, I cannot say my line. Then the argument cannot continue in the same old way that we have argued for the last decade. So, what you're doing is less simple. Just keep your mouth shut. They say, what's wrong with you? Why are you not saying? No. I refuse. Then a new conversation will start. Isn't it? So simple. Then it becomes like, why are you keeping your mouth shut? Why are you not answering you? Last time you always said this. And you can, I don't know what you're going to do after you give. But you have to figure a different direction to take that conversation. Yeah. And change happens. Change happens as simple as that. If you are mindful, you are aware in your daily life. Okay. Right. Yeah. 1.5 hours almost over. any question? No question. Okay, last 5 minutes. So I guess I should say something about dedication. Because I am a bit weird when I do this kind of teaching thing. I don't do a lot of things that people do. I don't recite prayers at the beginning, and I don't recite prayers at the end. Because I find that this is purely my experience. I mumble prayers for 30 years. I don't think I changed anything. In fact, those prayers become such a chore. And I can, at one point, I can recite my prayers at lightning speed. I have no idea what I'm talking about. It's just go, no? We used to, quite often we are advised that every day you should, you know, say, I go for refuge to Buddha, I go for refuge to Dharma, I go for refuge to all. Yeah, so, and then because I'm running out of time, so I learned to recite them on automatic, at lightning speed. Okay. So, and then I realized that this is reciting prayers, but just like a routine, you know. And I don't put much attention into it, and not much intention into it. And it sort of defeats its purpose anyway. It's just mumbling, yeah. So then I went to the other extreme, in which I refused to mumble any prayers. All prayers sort of disappeared when I present teaching. But anyway, that's just my idiosyncrasy. But quite often, at the end of a virtuous practice, a virtuous activity, we can also do a practice. We can also do something called dedication. Dedication is like acknowledge that what I just did is something positive. So create some kind of positive momentum. You know, I'm moving in the right direction where I want to go. You know, and I invest some time, invest my energy, my attention into it. But what I hope is virtuous. I hope you are paying attention. I don't know what's going on in your mind. Yeah. So. Now that I have done that, we can do this activity of dedication. It's like almost like you feel that you're gathering up that positive momentum and you specify a direction for it. You say, well, I want this to go towards fulfilling or actualizing some of my higher aspirations. I always put the word higher in that. Because if you don't mention it, people might have very low standards. And they might aspire for very low things. Yeah, low things like, oh, I hope I got a good program on. I used to say good program on the TV, but nowadays it's obsolete, that statement, yeah. So maybe, you know, Netflix will come out with a new series, a new season. Yeah. That would be wonderful. So, fine, I mean, it's okay to enjoy it. But we could aspire a bit higher than that. Higher than the next season from HBO or whatever. So what is your higher aspiration for yourself now? And then we dedicate, we say whatever positive things that I've done together, here, or wherever, I dedicate it to it. May it ripen, may it bring about those results that I aspire for. So may, for example, different people will aspire for different things, and you dedicate towards it. And you can also dedicate, not just for yourself, but for others. You know, especially if you know someone who is going through a difficult time. You would like to include them in your thoughts, in your so-called prayers. And that also may, I'm not sure whether it will help, but I would really like that my friends or my family or whoever share in this merit, share in this positive potential momentum, and that in some way it might bring relief from their suffering, from the causes of their suffering. It might be of benefit to them, bring them happiness, peace of mind, and sometimes for very specific reasons, you may say, or may they find quick recovery from their illness, may they be released from their depression and so on. So that's dedication. And I really like it because it's, I don't really know whether it works or not, but anyway, I find that it's a practice of mindfulness and kindness, you know, to encompass yourself and other, your aspiration and others in this activity. So that you basically just send something positive. Okay, so let's do a dedication together. So just sit quietly, you can close the eyes if you like. Think that by coming here this evening, by participating and learning about the Buddha's teaching, this helps to create some positive momentum, some merit from our investment of time, of energy, of attention. So may the positive momentum that I have created here today, I dedicate it towards the fulfillment of my higher aspirations. And take some time, and maybe you might want to list out what are those aspirations you have for yourself. And alongside with that, it would be also good to include others. It can be something generic for all beings, for all sentient beings everywhere, or something specific for someone or people that you know are in need of help, in difficult situation, or those that you care about and you would like to extend this merit for the fulfillment of their aspiration. So by this merit, may I and every sentient be able to achieve the state of enlightenment, and that we may be able to work and benefit all sentient beings. And may the precious mind of bodhicitta, altruism, that not yet born, arise. And may that have born not decline, but increase forevermore. Okay, thank you very much for your attention, and have a good week ahead. Thank you.